This is Designing Transition, a bilingual podcast about designing for systems-level change toward more sustainable and equitable futures. It is also a podcast about the transitions design is taking in practice when it's concerned with the complex and interconnected challenges societies face today. Today's conversation is in English. We will now direct our Spanish-speaking listeners to the commentary in Spanish. La conversación de hoy es en inglés. Te invitamos a escuchar nuestra discusión en español acerca de esta al final del episodio. Shannon Mayturn is a professor of anthropology at the New School for Social Research in New York City. Her work has focused on bookshelves, archives, libraries, media infrastructures, urban design, and smart cities. As Shannon told us in her interview, her research and teaching has dealt with areas where epistemology and information meet space as it's materialized at different scales. In this episode, myself, Erica Dorn, and colleague Sophia Bush spoke to Shannon about her practice, her pedagogical work, and the political implications of it. We recorded from three different locations, New York City, Mexico City, and Portland, Oregon, in the midst of the 2020 COVID pandemic. Because of Shannon's focus on exploring divergent patterns, disciplines, and epistemologies, it's a fascinating episode that certainly brought us to uncharted territories in very uncertain times. We hope you enjoy it as much as we did. Find the commentary in Spanish with Marisol and Silvana at the end of the interview.
Well, I thought we'd kind of kick off, just initially for you to synthesize what it is you do for our audience. So if you could describe in a kind of synthesized way who you are, what you do.
Well, that's always been a very hard question for me to answer. And because I cross a lot of disciplinary boundaries in the academy, and I don't just work within the academy, I do like to do a lot of partnerships with external organizations, design, advocacy, libraries, etc. It was kind of hard for me to describe what I do when I've had to go through those various faculty reviews, you know, when you apply for tenure, when you apply for a full professor. Those are the moments when I've had to sit down and kind of retroactively apply logic to the disparate things that I have done. And I think one way that I have described it to myself is that I'm interested in how the objects, spaces, and systems we design kind of manifest how we know the world, and how design kind of participates in shaping the way we know the world. So my work has spanned everything from kind of the design of classification systems and databases and how they scale up to the design of media objects, which in turn scale up to how we design architectures, systems, media infrastructures, and how ideally a logical system or a logical society, maybe you could say, has some legibility between as we translate between those systems at different scales. So more concretely, my work has touched on things like bookshelves, libraries, archives, media infrastructures, urban design, smart cities, logistical systems. So I kind of just went across the different scales there. So that's kind of what I do, where epistemology and information kind of meet space as they're materialized at different, as it is materialized at different scales.
Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, we did swim a bit in your work and it's vast. So I am impressed with how well you just synthesized your body of work. We should mention, we looked at your CV and we were like, wow, it's 45 pages.
A lot of that is service, as you can tell. That's a lot of committee.
It is. And I was impressed. And I was like, note to self, remember to write down everything you do in your career, because it was really beautiful just to see how much the generosity of, wait, this is an example of you giving to a community of people and just thinking about all the people that you've influenced. It was awesome to read.
Well, that's very nice to hear. But yes, I think that's very good advice. Every time you do, even if you just volunteer for like a day long workshop for someone, it's a good thing, good idea to add that to your CV also.
I think this is important information for our listeners.
Yes.
Great. So I think it was interesting because, you know, we were thinking after we invited you, we thought, wait, does Shannon even think of herself as a designer? So kind of the question that we wrote is, you're a scholar of media/infrastructure, this kind of intersection, but you're being interviewed for a design podcast. Why do you think that is? And how do you conceive of design or sort of situate yourself in this world of design?
Well, I'm going to kind of back into that question by saying, by talking about a more contemporary anecdote. I was in a department of media studies for 15 and a half years. And about a year and a half ago, I moved to a department of anthropology, in part because I needed a change. I didn't really want to leave New York. So I just moved laterally within the same institution. I moved from a kind of resolutely anti-disciplinary field to a discipline that is very invested in its disciplinarity, which has cultivated quite a bit of imposter syndrome. You know, I am pretty senior in my career, yet I have had a lot of identity crises over the past 2 years, wondering what am I, how certain fields have certain, not necessarily initiation rights, but are a lot more protective of the their disciplinary boundaries and gatekeepy in terms of who gets to count themselves as a member. So this question of, am I a designer? Am I not? I'm definitely not an anthropologist, even though I'm in an anthropology department. So these are questions I've been asking myself a lot. And I have been grateful, I think, through most of my career that librarians have kind of been very welcoming to me. I'm not trained as a librarian. Archivists also. I'm invited to give talks in architecture schools. I've been invited to kind of apply for deanships at design schools. And I'm saying, wait a second, are you sure I'm the right person you should be asking here? So I'm really grateful for that and honored. And I think maybe it's because of, I'm guessing, a certain ethos of interdisciplinarity where I really engage with like the professional literature, the professional discourses, the on-the-ground work of these different disciplines that I'm trying to tie together. And I hope that shows a respect for the different kind of disciplines that I am trying to weave together. I'm hoping it's a responsible mode of interdisciplinarity, which has kind of helped me to gain some traction and have some credibility with a variety of fields and not just the one that I'm explicitly trained in. In terms of whether or not I think of myself as a designer, I don't know that I would say that. Again, because I want to honor the specific knowledges and training of trained designers. At the same time, I do approach my pedagogy very much, I think, in the mind of a designer. Just the thought I give to the way I build a course website, to the way I sequence lessons, the different types of media I bring together in each lesson, the way I think about how knowledge stacks on top of each other, how to kind of design a lesson that incorporates modes of entry for students from multiple disciplinary perspectives. So I think those are questions that designers often ask themselves. And I think that I infuse that in my pedagogy and curriculum design and the way I do advising too. In my scholarship, I'm often thinking about multiple modalities simultaneously. So as I'm writing a project, I'm also thinking about how to productively illustrate it through sound or image or moving picture, et cetera, or interactive projects. So again, just showing that knowledge is produced in multiple modalities. And as I'm designing, I hear I'm using that word kind of gratuitous or capaciously. So as I'm designing a research project, I am kind of thinking across these multiple tracks simultaneously. So I would like to think that there's a designerly way that I approach even my scholarship. I also collaborate with a lot of designers. So I've worked with, for example, the Architectural League of New York and several projects. Been a consultant on some really fun and great library design projects they've done. I've consulted with a lot of other architects on specifically library design and public design projects, on some exhibition design projects for different institutions. So I think apparently other folks in external fields think that I can translate academic research into kind of designed or material modes of knowing that is maybe useful for the work that they do. So I don't know that I would call myself one, but I have been grateful to have other people kind of assume that if I'm not a designer, I'm at least capable of mediating between the things that I do and the design that they do.
Wow. That's really helpful to hear. Also, as someone who's not a designer, but doing a design PhD, it's something I heard, but maybe isn't explicitly what you were saying. I'm just curious how you would react to it, is that it sounds like potentially design is also a place where a lot of these disciplines get woven together, or sort of a space by through which lots of disciplines get mediated. Do you think that, yeah, would you agree with that statement that sort of you backed yourself into sort of being called a designer simply by being someone that's crossing boundaries all the time, and that design is a space for that?
I would say so. And I think really my dissertation topic helped me to realize that. I wrote about the design of Rem Koolhaas's Seattle Public Library. So I was kind of there on the ground when the design deliberations were happening. I interviewed the mayor, the city planner, the architects, all the citizen engagement groups, the librarians, the pages who reshelved the books, the people who worked at the loading dock. I realized like, oh my gosh, this one space where we have, first of all, tens of millions of dollars invested. So there's a lot at stake here that a whole city is invested in. So you're dealing with public process, you're dealing with politics, you're dealing with policy, you're also dealing with urban planning, you're dealing with logistics, you're dealing with collection development, which requires that you consider like the needs of the local indigenous population, homeless services, social services, all of these different, not only academic disciplines, but professions, skills are coalescing in the design of this single space. So that, so being on, watching that design evolve in response to all of these different needs over the course of a few years really helped to impress how that specific design projects, but I know others as well, really does require, if you want to do it responsibly, considering how the design thing or system is, in the Susan Lee Starr term, a boundary object for multiple disciplines.
Ooh, interesting. Susan Lee Starr.
Susan Lee Starr. She is one of the key kind of infrastructure studies person. She often wrote with Jeff Bowker. So they've published a lot of the canonical stuff in infrastructure studies.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, I think then my last question before I hand it off to Sophia relates to this, which is, it sounds like whether or not we as designers or designers know what they're stepping into every time, that their work will often intersect with many, many boundaries of potential influences, including, for example, if you're designing a library, interacting with indigenous populations and homeless services populations. So these unknowns of what you might encounter as a designer come up. I'm curious how you seek to influence design in that sense through your experiences in these other disciplines, and maybe even if you have any critique or words of wisdom for design and designers related to this. I think we're all well aware of the ways that design has gone wrong and is trying to bring about much more ethical processes and ways forward. We'd love to hear from you, your kind of thoughts on both how you're trying to influence this field and where you think it's needs improvement.
Sure. So I could just use, for example, like the library discussion, even demonstrating how appealing a well-designed library can be, how important it is to a community, can have huge repercussions in determining city budgeting, for instance. So in that case, I'm not only through my work and advocacy and writing, I'm trying to not only inform the design process to help architects and librarians and other stakeholders work together to design a space that's going to work as effectively as possible for the multiple publics it has to serve, but also by showing that design can be this, a design build or building or space or system can be such a charismatic object that can actually draw the attention of policymakers, funders, et cetera, to help to convince people that this is something that is actually worth committing money to for the long haul. So that was the project I did with the Architecture League. I think it was in 2014 or so. One of its underlying, maybe implicit motivations was to make this really dynamic project, a design study about how can we rethink the branch library, just to get libraries on the agenda for city council and the mayor. And they actually increased funding pretty dramatically, not just because of our project, but because I think there was something in a zeitgeist about, this was between the two kind of economic collapses also, so we're kind of on the trajectory upward, realizing what kind of society do we want to build? We would like to emphasize public culture. So that's one way I try to kind of think about how to mediate between the different stakeholders, how to design public processes is something else I've written about and hopefully have an influence on, how to not use participation as kind of a smokescreen for designers who already know what they want or who are hyper corporate neoliberal designers, like a Google organization, for instance, which is one I wrote about recently, who are just co-opting the visual language, the visual rhetoric of participation as a way to kind of pull people along to convince them of the benevolence of their contribution, for instance. So that's one area. And then when I write about smart cities, for instance, this is something that digital designers sometimes, this is again a terrible generalization, but kind of the engineering mindset, the techno-fetishism, techno-solutionism, the idea that if we can solve all problems by building an app for that, for instance, this is something by showing what's left out, what leaks, what populations are excluded when we technologize and datify everything. So a lot of my writing for the past 10 years has been about showing what is lost when we kind of try to put everything into digital design and not realize that there's material bodies that need analog kind of responses as well. So I critique kind of the techno-fetishism or techno-solutionism, and then also try to show other designers or artists who are doing interesting things to help, hopefully, help designers think about how they could supplement or revise their own processes. Not only designers, but also kind of policymakers, city administrations, and other kind of stakeholders. So those are two different examples of how I hope my work in some small way kind of influences not only design practice, but all of the kind of adjacent decision makers that designers have to work with to get stuff built or made.
And listeners can find some of these pieces in Places Journal, right? Is that your main platform for publishing some of this, like smart cities, or even, I love how you talked about the participation smokescreen. I think it's a really important.
Yeah, that was published in, actually, that was one of my first articles I ever published, was about the analyzing, and I was really nervous about it because I was pretty critical of Rem Koolhaas and the Office for Materials and Architecture's public design process, and made the architects not very happy with my first ever peer-reviewed article. Joshua Prince Ramis from Seattle, or from an island near Seattle, kind of came up to me at an event and was not very happy with me for what I said in that article. But so really early, it was a theme. And then a piece I published, I think it was just in February of this year, called Post-it Note City. It was about Sidewalk Labs, participatory process for Toronto, where they actually had a physical space they built, the architecture, the objects, the media, everything was supposed to kind of connote participation and engagement. And it was a little bit of a charade. So yeah, a lot of my stuff is published in Places, but I have pretty much everything I've ever published in all of my courses, which I think my teaching has always been completely integrated with my scholarship. They inform each other pretty kind of integrally. And that's all documented on my website.
Which is?
wordsinspace.net.
Thank you. I think that's a perfect segue because Sophia has related questions about your teaching and, okay, and beyond. So.
Great.
Yes, I actually I'm a big fan, and I think one of the things that I've read in the past couple of years that has influenced me the most has been your writing on dashboards, and I really like that piece. And in regards to what you were talking, kind of the impact that your work may have either in academia or beyond academia with policymakers, decision makers, and so on and so forth. I was wondering, or we were wondering, what do you think were the social implications of your work and what you desired them to be?
Meaning beyond, is when you say social implications, do you mean beyond academia? Is that how you're defining social?
Yeah.
Okay. So I also have been really gratified to be invited to talk to places like the American Institute of Architects, other kind of data science labs, some tech companies like Google Design actually invited me to participate in their conference, but I couldn't do it because I was, I think, teaching at the same time. So it's been really nice to see that there are kind of professional design organizations or companies who have invited me to share some of this work, which kind of that suggests at least that they find it resonant for their own practice. In terms of what I had hoped, I'm just glad that people read it, to be honest. I don't know that I ever write something hoping that it will identify the 10 audiences that I want to transform through my scholarship. I'm kind of pleasantly surprised to find that people actually read this stuff and tweet it and share it and assign it on syllabi. It's always, never gets old for me. It's always very satisfying and flattering. But my ideal goal is to have, I usually try to bring at least two professions or two disciplines who don't often talk to each other together in each article. So for instance, I wrote this piece last summer about fugitive libraries because I was noticing in the library world, which is a very white profession. I know this is an issue in architecture and lots of design fields too. Highly feminized, very white, long history of kind of institutionalized racism, as is the case in many fields as well. And I wanted to figure out what I as a white lady could contribute. So I wrote this piece that tried to amplify the voices of multiple Black, mostly feminist, fugitive librarians who were building kind of these counter libraries. And in that case, I was really hoping that, first of all, I would write an article that would do justice to and would not place my own voice above the voices of the people who I was trying to amplify. I tried to kind of sublimate my own voice in that piece. So I wanted to put their work, artists and designers' work, in productive relation to those of trained librarians and kind of urban planners who are thinking about the role of libraries and how they are also kind of things to think with. They offer important historical lessons and things that can propel us to think about how to design more equitable urban futures, for instance. And I was, again, really very gratified to see that the piece seemed to do that. I didn't get any hate mail after it. I was really nervous about that piece because it was a kind of sensitive topic. So I try to write things that bring together a couple, at least two different disciplines, and hope that it will provide a forum for a productive conversation.
I was actually just wondering, when bringing these different kind of disciplines or points of view in your writings, who are your favorite collaborators, or who are the people you really like to work with?
I love working with, these are very broad categories, but featuring different artists and designers' work. I love collaborating with librarians. You know, lots of people have trauma stories about their dissertations. I chose to work with public librarians who are essentially all about, you want to write about our institution? We'll take you to the back room, open up all the filing cabinets where you can have access to everything. That's not everybody's kind of charmed story of dissertation research. I had people whose institutional or professional commitment was to open access to knowledge. So they were the ideal collaborators for a research project. So that really kind of set me up in my foundational years to have a certain kind of, it's not necessarily a generalizable expectation, but a very fortunately positive early experience with collaborative research. So librarians are great to work with, archivists in most cases, artists, and especially when I'm featuring different artists and designers' work, to use them as things to think through to illustrate larger kind of critical concepts. I haven't done a whole lot of collaborative writing, I will say, because a lot of my collaboration happens in other venues, like working on projects together or design studies or exhibitions. Most of my writing, in part because I tend to write pretty fast too, that schedule doesn't work for a lot of people who might be writing alongside. So most of my writing is solo. That said, just over the past 3 weeks or so, I did work with two graduate students on a piece that was invited by a journal called Big Data and Society about, everybody's being invited to write think pieces about COVID, for instance. We wanted to write something about alternative, often feminist approaches to data visualization of public health. So I worked with a cartographer and a student who's just now starting a dissertation about data visualization in the development world. So their two interests kind of really, I think, complemented what I bring very well. So we had a really nice, productive collaboration, and it was kind of the first peer-reviewed journal article for both of them. So it was nice to be able to share my experience and to learn from them simultaneously.
Wow, that sounds amazing. And actually, it ties well with my following two questions, which kind of circle back to education and pedagogy. We were actually looking at your website on Anthropology of Networks, and it really looked amazing. And we think it's kind of good example of the way you approach design education, what you were talking a few minutes ago. And so we were wondering if you had any thoughts on design education, the way it should be developed, the future of it, any thoughts around it?
Well, it depends on whether or not you think that's actually an example of a design course. It was designed as a freshman sophomore anthropology course, the anthropology design class that you just mentioned. And I will say that that class in particular was designed in collaboration with my friend and colleague, Greta Byram. And the course really represents her expertise, because over the course of the past decade or so, her area, she has built up her entire profession around community networks, working with the New America Foundation and now her own organization to provide connectivity to disenfranchised populations in New York, in Appalachia, and other parts of the world. So the class really reflects kind of her expertise, just as much kind of like my pedagogical experience, I think. So I don't know that I would love maybe at the next phase of my career, and hopefully that will happen soon, I would love to do a lot more collaborative teaching, specifically in a design school, like partnering on studios with people. I have taught mostly kind of seminars in media studies and anthropology, where I have half of my students are designers who take them as an elective class. So what they're bringing to the table is very much informing our collaborative work, the way I design the course. I don't know that I am qualified to have much to say about what design education should, what futures it should take. I just would hope that kind of my engagement with different critical concepts could be useful to designers. I mean, the fact that I have lots of designers who take my classes suggests that they find that to be the case. But I would love to bring those into kind of a more traditional, but still experimental studio format, which is not something I've had a whole lot of opportunity to do, based on where my courses are housed and where they have been housed for the past 15 years.
Thank you so much. And I think, Erica, you have a couple of more questions.
Oh, yeah, I saw there's one more on this bridging. Oh, yeah. So I think what you just said around bringing it into the studio format hit on that point. Okay, that's good. And we were curious how you bridge theory and practice. And it sounds like you do, and you'd like more studio formats to be able to bridge some of your theory into practice.
Absolutely. I mean, and I realize this sounds kind of like a maybe a cop-out answer, but there are certain kind of really frustrating institutional limitations. Like, because of the disciplines I've taught in, my courses are no longer than an hour and 50 minutes once a week. Really hard to do a studio. I have no budget for studio trips. I have no budget, no kind of institutional format to do a lot of the things that you do in a studio course, for instance. So these are in part the kind of rigid institutional limitations that are placed on what type of pedagogical experimentation. I've also had a lot of students who, most of my students have worked full time. So it's not as if you can ask them to go on a Friday field trip, for instance. So all of these different types of limitations, they're opportunities too, but recognizing the population that I'm working with, how to make the richest and most accommodating experience for them, and working within the institutional structure that I have, it's kind of determined what I've been able to do. Also bridging theory and practice, I think all of my courses do that. Even though they're not studios, I try to bring kind of design exercises into them. Throughout the entire semester, I try to show examples of not only theorists, academics who have written about concepts, but also designers and artists who have experimented with or materialized those concepts in their work to get students thinking, even the political scientist or the policy student thinking about how a building or an interface is a really important kind of politically significant way to operationalize certain values or critical concepts. And then that opens up space for them to think about doing an unorthodox format for their final projects. So I've had, for example, sustainability kind of PhD students who have done maps for their final projects, anthropologists who have done kind of podcasts. So really asking big questions, not only about what are the research questions that are interesting to me, but also who do I want to reach with this? Who's my audience? Who are my publics? And then what formats are actually most effective in sharing my knowledge with those people? So it breaks us out of the research paper format, which probably does not seem at all kind of terribly progressive or novel in a design school, but it is relatively novel for students who have only written papers for 16 years, for instance.
I think
so. Those are just some ways where I try to bring some,
No, I think even in your early description of your work, I think you did very much talk about materialization of your theories when you mentioned how it manifests on the bookshelf or how it, So it seems like you're always looking for materialization of some form, which is really helpful for me as a researcher.
Glad to hear that. Yes.
Yeah. great. So I think given the time that we're in, I think it would be really interesting to hear, you know, from your own trajectory and perspective, being involved in media, what is the landscape ahead in media in particular? What are you seeing or predicting or speculating on about how, yeah, I guess the future of media is the question.
So you are asking about media, not about design.
Right? No.
Okay.
Asking about media. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, I was just asked recently to be part of a panel discussion in San Francisco about, like, what's the future of design education? And I said, like, I am not qualified to answer that question. And everybody is asking that question specifically in relation to COVID and police brutality and systematized injustice. You know, these three huge major forces kind of coalescing right now that are inspiring people to ask these fundamental, essential, existential questions about, like, what role can design play in the post fill in the blank world? And then how could we design learning experiences to make that world possible? So I'm definitely not qualified. Those are really interesting questions. I'm going to follow them as other people answer them. But in terms of media, this is something that we've been seeing for some of the stuff that we're happening, we're seeing right now is to some degree maybe unprecedented or an exacerbated form of a phenomenon we've seen, especially since the Trump election. Just the proliferation of misinformation, filter bubbles, different epistemological universes, which is something I was just talking about people on with on Twitter today. So I read an article in The Atlantic last week about QAnon and how they have their different discussion boards and this promotion of, like, doing your own research, which seems like a really noble thing to do, like doing your own empirical research to find out what the truth is rather than just kind of absorbing what the mainstream media offers to you. But their understanding of what constitutes research, what is a certifiable or credible resource, just blows my mind. Like, we are living in totally different universes of truth right now, all of which are mediated through different kind of platforms with different kind of indices or metadata of credibility attached to them. So I feel like media literacy is something that a lot of folks in media studies have been promoting as a fundamental liberal art for, like, the past several decades. It is not something that's prioritized in kind of primary school curricula, for instance, or in college curriculums. It is incredibly important, but I also think it has to be complexified to realize that just telling people, like, how do you tell what the political bias of a news site is? That is not enough anymore, because we are dealing with people who have totally different understandings of what constitutes truth, and if truth is even something we're pursuing together. So we have to have really kind of way more complicated and robust understandings of how to teach media literacy and what the fundamental questions of that field or set of skills would be. That should be in collaboration between media studies scholars and, I think, information studies people, librarians, et cetera. So that's what I think is something that's going to be fundamental, and it should be implemented through all levels of education, because we see how important it is to pretty much everything that goes on in terms of democratic process, public health, all different domains. It has implications.
And what do you think are the most important leverage points or interventions or pivots that need to happen, and over what course of time, in order to perhaps realize this vision where we are at least more media literate? Certainly there's also questions of, you know, ownership of the media itself. Mm-hmm. Curious a little bit more about materializing.
Well, this is maybe a good way to segue into thinking about design, because there are all different points of potential intervention, all of which can be designed through policy, through materialization. So there are different ways or modes in which design can shape some of these leverage points. It could be, for example, policy design, where you think about how much big tech should be regulated, for instance. Whether we should break up big monopolies, for instance, if Google and Facebook are actually public utilities and should be run as such. Again, those are not just the domain of design, but I think designers can have some useful kind of contributions to those discussions. So those are kind of the more policy macro scale considerations. There's also being more understanding, helping people understand the macro scale infrastructures, how media get to your phone, for instance, understanding all the satellites and cables, and who owns what in that terrain that allows us to have seemingly seamless, instantaneous connection to everyone. Who designs our devices, the supply chains through which they're put together, who designs our interfaces and the kind of the modes of user experience, for instance. What modes of subjectivity are produced through the design of an interface? How content is filtered? How the design of widgets on our phones in a way compartmentalizes certain modes of knowledge and ways of knowing and forms of experience which have an epistemological significance. So all of these different things are an important part of our points of leverage for improving media literacy. You could also design curriculum. So how do you teach some of these things to an elementary school student versus a college student in different disciplines? Why should a business major or a hard science major recognize that these are relevant concerns for them also? So multiple institutions, multiple levels of the technological stack, kind of multiple design points of entry, I think, demonstrate all the different pivot points, hinges, pick your metaphor, kind of openings to potentially affect something within this terrain.
Thank you. Sophie and I ended up recently working on a project with Heather Chaplin on her Wicked Problem Task Force. We designed and facilitated a couple-day gathering right as COVID hit about the future of the free press. And it was good exposure for us into a lot of the issues you just described. And what I certainly, it's fascinating how quickly you just listed off probably 100 different areas that are intersecting and necessary for to be coalescing and working in concert towards a more idealized or more idealized futures in which we are not in such a kind of destable idea of what truth is, or, you know, there's a lot of potential better futures than the one we're existing in terms of media.
Right.
I'm just curious whether or not you see whether or not it's important that these interventions, so to speak, are working in concert with each other, because it sounds to me like they're so disparate, the number of things that need to be happening, yet also necessary to be in concert. Any thoughts on how that's done, if it's necessary or not to be working in concert? And if you see that happening, who and how is that space being held?
That is a very good question. And this is where I think, I find it productive to think across these things, not necessarily simultaneously, but in sequence within a bounded time-space continuum. So I'll give you an example. Like in my graduate class I taught this semester, we looked at kind of datafied spaces and landscapes, not smart cities, precision agriculture, logistical systems, migration, how all of these different spatial phenomena and terrains are infused with a data logic. So we did this multi-scalar analysis. We looked at the data model, how that's kind of represented in the artifacts and interfaces, which in turn scales up to the way that like feedlots and border checkpoints are designed, and then how logistical systems are organized. So it's helpful to see how certain logics scale up or down across those different systems and where the breakpoints are, where the frictions are. So I think there is real value to looking at these systems simultaneously or in sequence within this context of a class or a workshop, for instance. But not everybody has the luxury of doing that. And as you said, each of these points of design or editorial choices that are made by journalists, for instance, they're all working with different disciplinary training, different kind of professional conventions, maybe working towards different end goals. They have a different telos, a different kind of ideological goal. So it's really, there is epistemological, pedagogical value to trying to integrate them, but at the same time, there's a loss of freedom when you try to create an all-encompassing agenda that forces everybody to work toward the same end. Sometimes having a mismatch between those different levels of the stack can actually be productive if the friction is tangible, because often we see where things don't match up, that's when we start to ask questions about their designedness, about the fact that they're not naturalized phenomenon, that this productive friction that we're experiencing here where the interface doesn't quite match the user experience that they want us to have, that's when we start to ask critical questions. So I don't have a good answer to your, I think there's value in an artificial learning experiment or experience like a classroom to think across them, think about how they can be productively integrated, but also recognize there's a lot to be gained through productive tensions through that lack of integration also.
So beautifully said. Thank you so much on that point.
Sure.
Because I think there's a lot of, especially as I've in the world of transition design or even in systems change, there is a lot of emphasis being put on coalescing and orchestrating interventions so that they're working in concert. And I think to your point, the tangible friction and spontaneity is sometimes what then brings about a new emergent property or new emergent value that otherwise wouldn't be available if we were trying to kind of, in a sense, over control the process by keeping it coalesced in one. So very, very important point, I think, for our audience.
Well, I'll just give you one quick example. I mean, there is a critical librarian named Emily Drabinsky, who has written a lot about kind of queer classification, for instance. So as you might know, classification systems, which might seem kind of old school and staid library classification systems, but they have a long legacy that informs the way kind of artificial intelligence is classified. So there's a long trail of influence of a lot of these 19th century technologies, which were built on the ontology of a couple racist, sexist men. So like Melville Dewey, whom we kind of heroicize as being the father of libraries, is actually not a very nice guy. And a lot of his own biases are built into classification systems that still have legacies today. So her argument is that rather than fixing them, even though you can kind of submit a proposal to change classifications, to rather than having kind of homosexuality listed under deviance, you know, as a instead kind of reposition it within the system so that it has that, doesn't have that kind of ideological tinge to it. But there can also be potential learning opportunities where you do see those tensions within the system. They could be a great point for discussion, a great kind of learning opportunity when you have time to sit down with students to talk about why things are the way they are and who was affected by these imperfect systems. Not everybody has the opportunity to sit down for an hour with a librarian to talk about these things. But when those opportunities do present themselves, I think they can have much more long-lasting and profound effects.
So, yes. Yes, actually, absolutely. I'm so interested and just amazed with this conversation. I have so many kind of other questions, but we need to finish. And so we just wanted to finish with a kind of broader question. What is your greatest inquiry and what would your question be?
My greatest inquiry, wow. You're talking about a timeless question, something that's inspired me for a long time, or right now?
Either way, anything bad.
I'll start by saying right now, and I think it's not a novel question. I think a lot of people are asking right now. It's like, how can I, as a white person, offer something meaningful to the moment? How can I take the things that I'm working on that actually, it's not that I'm worried about my work will be irrelevant, who cares? There are things that are way more important in the world right now than whatever I'm going to be publishing or writing in the next few months or years. But how can I contribute something that's actually of use to the world, given how much, not the world has changed, that the past few months have kind of brought to a head or highlighted things that have been plaguing society for centuries, for decades, if not centuries. So these are not new phenomena. So this the very kind of contemporary question is, how can I do meaningful work? And when do I need to just sit back and be quiet for a while? Maybe nobody needs what I'm doing right now. Maybe I should just shut up and listen. So that's the big question. And then the larger one is, could you phrase the question again, please? I forget what the original question was.
Sure. Like the greatest inquiry, I'm thinking it perhaps if that is the kind of contemporary question, what you're thinking at this moment, what would be kind of an umbrella question for the following, I don't know, couple of years in regards to your work and the type of work you want to do?
Well, I think it's a pretty similar question. I already have like two new, again, I'm not, as I mentioned earlier, I like to write articles much more than books, but I already do have two kind of book projects in mind for the longer future. One of them is about trees as media, and one of them is about furniture as
trees?
Media.
Trees as media?
Yes, arboreal media. The other one is about furniture. So it's really thinking about all the different ways in which the designed or not designed natural, quote unquote, landscape not just communicates to us, but serves as an important agent in all of our communications. So that's my bigger question. It's like how the designed and natural world can kind of work together to both function as an integral agent within and facilitate our modes of communication. So those are bigger questions. And then I think that will involve, again, a lot of interdisciplinary work, not only traditional scholarship, but I love to collaborate with designers. And I'm drawing on a lot of design and artwork for these two areas of investigation. So I think those are big enough questions that will probably sustain me until I retire or die, whatever. But
I have a really quick follow-up question on Boreal Media. It makes me think like, okay, is this like post-humanism? Who are the authors that are influencing you most in this realm of human decentered post-human thinking?
So there are even the whole political science research about the history of forest design, for instance. The fact that nature has been, if we look kind of at the deep time of our virgin forests, they have in many cases been designed as well. If we look back several hundred years or thousands of years, the fact that forests are like heavily managed environments also, the fact that humans have been shaping what constitutes nature for a very long time. So I don't know that I can identify specific thinkers, but that's one area of consideration. Also how important kind of tree-based materials have been in the history of communication. The fact that when we were using clay styluses or clay tablets, we used reed styluses, we used papyrus to make rags and pulp, wood pulp for paper. The fact that celluloid is based on materials that are kind of partly tree-based. The fact that now a lot of our 3D printing is based on kind of tree-based waste products. So trees, plants have been an integral part of our communications material or substrates for the entire history of human communication, and they still are. So that's one area. Also, a lot of the research about kind of plant sentience, the wood wide web, plant-based communication, that's another area that I want to look more into. I am blanking on some of the other areas, but there have been a lot of interesting exhibits about trees recently. Trees as kind of an inspiration for artwork, trees as a symbol that are conveniently used to greenwash different design projects, them as substrates for different types of design practices. So that was a very rambling thing. I haven't figured out all the chapters in the yes, but those are some of the areas I'm interested in.
We could ask a million more questions but we won't because it's 5 p.m. in New York, I think.
Yes.
Okay. but thank you so much, Shannon. This was really, really remarkable interview. Just chock full of lots of tidbits. So I know our listeners are going to be following you on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
It's my name. Okay. Not very creative. Yeah.
Well, anything else, Sophia, do you want to just wrap up?
Just really, really want to thank you, Shannon. This has been wonderful. And yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been an honor to speak with both of you. And I hope our paths cross virtually or in person at some time. And I wish you good luck with your own research. I hope you'll keep me abreast of what you're doing too.
Yeah, we will. And we should bring you to CMU. Have you come to Pittsburgh CMU before?
I was there 2 years ago. Yes, I did get it was a joint visit between Pitt and CMU. I forget exactly. Oh, I gave my talk at CMU and led a workshop at Pitt. This was February of 2018. But I grew up in State College, Pennsylvania. So Pittsburgh was my closest city and I love Pittsburgh. So I would be happy to visit again sometime.
Awesome.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll be in touch.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. So
thank
much.
You.
Thanks. Well. Great. You too.
Bye.
Acabamos de escuchar la entrevista que hicieron Sofía y Erika con Shannon Matter, profesora de antropología en The New School for Social Research en la ciudad de Nueva York. Ahora Silvana y yo haremos una síntesis en español de la charla y compartiremos reflexiones a partir de ella. Al principio de la conversación, Shannon nos explica cuál es su área de investigación y trabajo. En lo personal, me llamó mucho la atención esta frase que menciona que el diseño es donde la epistemología y la información se encuentran con el espacio y se materializan en diferentes escalas. ¿Cómo la ves, Silvana?
Sí, a mí también me llamó mucho la atención esa frase. Ella nos explicaba cómo en realidad en toda su trayectoria ha traído a diferentes espacios múltiples miradas disciplinares, y justamente por eso es que ella lo sintetiza un poco de esa forma, en donde quizás las formas de conocer o de acercarnos al conocimiento, y que el conocimiento es mucho más que información, evidentemente, es necesario que se genere un espacio en donde eso se articule, pero también se materialice. Esto fue uno de los aspectos interesantes que surgió en la charla, en donde ella un poco empezó a ver el rol del diseño, o bueno, quizás como una forma más diseñística de encarar los proyectos o de verlos, a través de la materialización, a veces de teorías, de ideas en la práctica, y a veces simplemente en traer a la materialidad generaciones colectivas.
Sí, y habla mucho como de esta analogía del objeto, ¿no? O sea, como el diseño como un objeto, ya sea como un objeto material o que tú puedes tocar, o como un objeto pensando más como en los sistemas que se crean por medio del diseño. Y es interesante cómo también después de que Erika le pregunta que si el diseño es un espacio donde un mosaico de disciplinas se entrelazan unas entre otras, ella hace referencia a este concepto del boundary object, o el objeto limítrofe, ¿no? Que es introducido por primera vez por Susan Lengstar en 1989, y habla como el diseño siendo un objeto limítrofe entre una multiplicidad de disciplinas.
Exacto, eso fue también bien interesante, porque lo que propone es que el diseño está ubicándose como un espacio en donde se puede generar, o se puede abrir un espacio para generar un intercambio de cosas diferentes, de información y de conocimiento, permitir que diferentes comunidades, grupos, instituciones puedan dialogar entre sí, que es clave justamente con esta concepción de la interdisciplina en donde ella un poco se alberga, o donde ella comenta que se sitúa su trabajo. De hecho, en la charla nos empieza a contar sobre algunos de los ejemplos en los que ha trabajado proyectos, y nos comenta sobre el caso particular del proyecto en relación a una biblioteca pública, y cómo justamente ese espacio del proyecto de diseñar la biblioteca tuvo múltiples funciones. Y ahí es donde aparece este concepto de objeto limítrofe, donde se lograron conectar actores públicos, empresas, proyectos y programas de la ciudad vinculados a diferentes áreas, como aspectos más que tienen que ver con la economía o los fondos, o cómo se usan los fondos públicos, pero también cosas como áreas donde se ocupan de las personas que viven en la calle, o otros servicios sociales. Aparte de los arquitectos, que tradicionalmente quizás podrían estar trabajando en un proyecto de este tipo, en diseñar un espacio, pero a la vez los propios bibliotecólogos y archivólogos, que justamente son personas con las que ella ha tendido a trabajar bastante durante los últimos años, y los identifica como personas muy interesantes con las cuales colaborar. ¿Qué te pareció a vos, Marisol, en ese sentido?
Sí, se me hizo bastante interesante las cosas, o sea, diferentes aspectos que ella estaba mencionando que descubrió por medio de su investigación, ¿no? De su trabajo doctoral con las bibliotecas públicas, y cómo empezó a ver todas esas conexiones entre las diferentes disciplinas, y cómo los diferentes actores tienen una variedad de roles, pero entran todavía dentro de este proceso de diseño, ¿no? Y luego también, bueno, moviéndonos un poquito más hacia el lado un poquito más polémico de la conversación, pues empezaron a hablar Erika, Sofía y Shannon sobre cuáles son las áreas de mejora que existen en el diseño desde su perspectiva, ¿no? Y a mí me llamó mucho la atención que subrayó dos cosas que hasta cierto punto parecen un poquito contradictorias. Por un lado, hizo una crítica sobre cómo los procesos participativos muchas veces son utilizados como una cortina de humo, cuando los diseñadores ya saben qué es lo que van a diseñar. Y mencionó entidades específicas como Google o cualquier otro diseñador neoliberal hipercorporativo que utilice una retórica de participación como una forma de convencer sobre la benevolencia de sus contribuciones. Eso es por un lado. Y por el otro, dice que una de las cosas que descubrió por medio de su investigación es que el diseño no solamente sirve como un proceso en el cual pues, se unen todas estas diferentes disciplinas, como mencionó antes, sino que también funciona como un objeto carismático para llamar la atención de los servidores públicos o de cualquier persona que te puede dar fondos para financiar una iniciativa como esa y que ayuda para convencer a la gente de que esto es algo que vale la pena para comprometer tu dinero, ¿no? Entonces es un poquito así como que sí tiene esa parte que llama la atención, pero es importante saber cómo utilizarlo, ¿no? Y entra un poquito, pues, aspectos de ética en el diseño.
Sí, exacto. Y ese es un punto en realidad bastante interesante también que surge de la discusión y es algo que parece caracterizar mucho el trabajo de Shannon, en donde muchas de las preguntas se vuelven, como decías Marisol, en el fondo éticas, y ella lo que propone es poder potenciar las capacidades quizás para el pensamiento crítico a todo nivel. Ella propone, cuando le preguntamos sobre el vínculo entre este tipo de abordaje o cómo podría incluso mejorarse o adoptar estas estrategias para mejorar la educación en el diseño, ella nos comentaba que en realidad no se ubica tanto en ese espacio, de hecho no se ve a ella misma como diseñadora, sino sí adoptando formas de pensar ciertos espacios, especialmente propuestas pedagógicas, en donde justamente lo que busca es poner en cuestionamiento algunas ideas y fomentar ese pensamiento crítico para entender un poco cómo funcionan las cosas, quién las hace y para quién, quién se beneficia y quién está quedando excluido. En este sentido nos comentaba que ella ha dado muchos cursos en donde han participado muchos diseñadores y quizás eso sería uno de los aspectos que parecería que los diseñadores necesitan reforzar y quizás son los aspectos o capacidades que logran empezar a desarrollar en esos espacios en los que ella se mueve, que en general tienden a estar vinculados más con el campo de la información o el periodismo que con lo que podemos pensar como el diseño tradicional. Al final, justamente lo que ella propone en relación al fortalecimiento del diseño es poder tener una mirada mucho más integradora y donde estas capacidades que están dadas como para potenciar en realidad trasciendan mucho más el diseño en algunos aspectos, porque ella, sus cursos están ofrecidos para un público muy amplio, y que en esos espacios puedan confluir justamente diferentes tipos de disciplinas, especialmente ella propone expertos que vienen del campo de la información, bibliotecólogos, archivólogos, como personas muy particulares que tienen mucho para aportar a la comprensión de ciertos problemas, y también cómo se puede empezar a deconstruir un poco las problemáticas que se plantean para abrir otros espacios de diálogo y de posibilidad, para en definitiva empezar a discutir no tanto un proyecto de diseño en sí mismo como el problema, sino empezar a ir hacia preguntas más fundamentales sobre cómo queremos darle forma al mundo. ¿A vos qué te pareció por ese lado, Marisol?
Sí, creo que eso habla mucho acerca de también como que la forma en que ella empieza a pensar en cómo combinar aspectos que, o como dice ella, ¿no? Dos disciplinas que normalmente no hablan con entre ellas, ¿no? Y creo que eso tiene mucho que ver con esa forma de apertura en la cual, pues, tal vez combinas ya sea dos disciplinas o dos problemáticas también, porque habla de cómo en su investigación o en varios de los cursos muchas veces se hablan de ciertas cosas como combinar el futuro de las bibliotecas y cómo es su relación con el racismo institucionalizado, y habla de el ejemplo de en el que ella escribió un libro en el que trató de como traer a las voces que han tenido la experiencia de este racismo institucionalizado y cómo eso tiene relación con el sistema que existe actualmente para las bibliotecas y cuál sería como un futuro deseable, ¿no? En el cual este racismo institucionalizado no es parte de ellas.
Uh-huh. Exacto. Y quizás un poco volviendo, haciendo como un cierre en un círculo, uno de los temas que ella plantea que tienen que ver con los problemas que existen en las estructuras que tenemos, tiene que ver justamente con esa mirada crítica de deconstrucción y de entender quién está quedando afuera, especialmente cuando las soluciones se empiezan a proponer como demasiado guiadas por la tecnología, ¿no? Como hablamos un poco antes. Cuando se empieza a descartar otras formas de aprender el mundo, otros conocimientos que puedan ser más plurales y desatender a las personas que necesiten otro tipo de mediación o interacción con el mundo más corpórea o corporal y no tanto mediada por el mundo virtual. Quizás podemos un poco, para ir cerrando, ver también avanzar el otro punto que ella nos comentó, donde ahora últimamente le interesa mucho ir quizás un poco más allá de un aspecto más centrado en lo humano y ir a entender, por ejemplo, cuál es el rol que tienen los árboles o las estructuras arbóreas y que han tenido en todo el desarrollo de la información como campo y como herramientas que usamos, y más allá, es decir, en última instancia una apertura a otras formas de conocimientos y cómo eso puede informar nuestra práctica, quizás como diseñadores, que tiene mucho que ver con el marco del diseño para las transiciones. ¿No te parece, Marisol?
Así es. Sí, pues hablando de estos modos de conocimientos plurales, como pues en específico el interés de ella en el futuro de su investigación, hablando de los árboles como medios y cómo no solamente a la hora de que un árbol se pueda convertir en papel y convertirse en un modo de comunicación, sino también cómo los diseñadores los han convertido en muebles y son medios para la conversación o para cualquier otro tipo de diálogo, y cómo pudiera ser como los árboles como un proyecto de diseño para hasta la sostenibilidad de la vida, ¿no? Y pues nada más que tratar de seguir lo que está haciendo Shannon y ver qué a dónde nos lleva este tipo de pensamientos que ella está trayendo a la mesa.
Exacto. Bueno, esa es más o menos la síntesis de nuestra conversación, o bueno, la conversación de Sofía, Erika y Shannon. Y esta es nuestra síntesis. Esperamos que les haya interesado y que puedan seguir su trabajo, que tiene muchísimo material online en su web para ir indagando más a fondo sobre estas ideas. Los esperamos entonces en el próximo episodio. Chao.
Gracias por acompañarnos en Diseño en Transición. Este podcast fue presentado por Silvana Jury, Erika Dorn, Marisol Ortega Payanés y Sofía Bosch Gómez. La producción de audio fue realizada por Thomas Yun. Síguenos en Twitter en @DeanTransition. También puedes visitar nuestro sitio web tinyurl.com/DeanTransition, donde puedes suscribirte al podcast ya sea en iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify o tu aplicación favorita. Nos vemos en el próximo episodio y que viva la transición.